psychological barriers. And I'm reflecting this psychological barrier also in the survey frontline finding in Indonesia. But in our context, psychological barriers is more on fear or panics when there is a disaster came. So even though there is a preparedness measures that have been taken by the community, they did the mock drill, the disaster mock drill, and then they have this evacuation arrangement. But when it when the disaster strikes, then they disoriented and they forget the drill that they have done. So this is the psychological barrier that we have in Indonesia. But here it's I think it's more that the unwillingness of the people to do the measure. So I think in this case there are different perception of the psychological barrier. One is the unwillingness to do changes, preparedness, and then while in Indonesian context, it is more on the fear, panic, etc. And so it's just a reflection. And then another comment is you said that about the there is a political commitment from the governor. Yeah, it's very good, and I think it's from the previous on the local risk governance of the frontline survey. It's also I think political will is also part of the successful DRR measures in the area. So I want to know how you can get this political will. Is it because of the internal factors of the governor itself, because he has a good vision, or there is a lobbying process so that there is a political will in place? Because for in Indonesia, political will is very much depends on the personality, the individuals, rather than the external influencing the head of the district. Like for example, in Gunung Kidul, the issues that attracts the head of the district is about tourism. So if you want to say something about DRR or about the climate change, then we have to link what is the relations between tourism and DRR and community resilience. So I want to know how you influence the political will. And I think it also would be useful if there is a visual illustrations about the step that is taken to do this convergence approach. And also, like, when I see this, there are so many initiatives that has been done in the ground. So maybe and also there are many different actors playing in that. So if you could give a visual illustration, I think it would be useful. And another question is there any commonalities and differences between the four communities? Like, for example, the characteristic and maybe the social modalities of these four, or they basically just the same? And maybe it's also good to give illustrations because there are so many actors at different level from the community with the ISDA, right? The islands, ISDA, sustainability, yeah. Development
Alliance.
Yeah,
Alliance.
And then there is UP
Visayas.
UP Visayas, and then there are other actors in different levels. So what kind of the advocacy roles taken and how they influence things differently in different level? And how to ensure that after the project ends, there is a transfer of power and roles from UP Visaya to the ISDA. Yeah, I think that's all that I've got so far. Thank you.
Wow. Okay. Have you got all that, Grace? Yeah. Would you like to talk about that or hear some more questions first? Or?
I think you're talking. Feedback and then
feedback
yeah,
first.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. So regarding your first comment about the psychological barrier, we use that term because remember when we did the frontline survey in 2015, we developed the codes.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
when we were consolidating the findings, we find it the most appropriate code. So we included the refusal or the behavior of the people. They don't want to evacuate under this code, the psychological barrier. Most of them don't like to evacuate because they don't want to leave their properties. They are afraid that someone might steal their belongings. Yeah. But at present, since a lot of organizations are already working in the area, different awareness raising campaigns have already been conducted, like UP Visayas and other INGO Save the Children. Your second comment about the political commitment. We were fortunate because the governor in the province of Iloilo was very supportive because it was timely that Typhoon Haiyan happened in 2013. So he saw the great destruction that the disaster brought to the community. And a lot of different humanitarian workers went in the area, and he saw that there was no system, there was no coordination among the groups. So when UP Visayas Foundation introduced the idea of convergence strategy, he was very receptive to it, and he even recommended that a memorandum circular, it's like a policy, that memorandum circular will be adopted by the municipality of Carles so that it will be institutionalized. And UP Visayas, the network of UP Visayas was also very helpful in convincing the governor to support the strategy. They have been working in Iloilo, I think, since 1990s, because University of the Philippines is the oldest university in the country, in my country. So they have a very nice reputation. So the governor is really confident that they will be doing great work. They will be very helpful to the islands. So it was not difficult to gain his trust and support. And also, we have this new law, the Philippine Disaster Risk Reduction and Management Act of 2010, which mandates the local government to really invest in disaster risk reduction, to be more proactive. So it is part of the governor's responsibility to set up a structure, starting from the province down to the village. It is also part of their responsibility to allocate funding, structure funding, and appoint or delegate a personnel that will lead different disaster risk reduction efforts. When they don't do that, they will be penalized. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's, I think that's the most
strong
influence. That's why the government or the governor really provided his support. Okay, for your third comment about the visual illustration, actually I have a draft illustration, but I just didn't include it in the paper because it's heavy, the file will be heavy, so it will not be easy to send. But I already have it. Your fourth question was about the commonalities
and differences.
Actually, because they are the four barangays are part of the Gigantes Islands, I don't see a lot of differences. In terms of livelihood, most of them depend on fishing. They are confronted with issues on social lack of access to birth and health facilities. They are also involved in unsafe livelihood activities because the poverty incident in the in the whole island is really high. It's 80%, and it is the highest in the Visayas, one of the highest in the Visayas region. That's why there's a conflict actually right now in terms of promoting biodiversity conservation and natural environmental protection, because they have to survive. So there's a conflict. Although a lot of organizations have been doing awareness raising, it's still a struggle. What was your fifth about the advocacy role of the?
Yeah, in different level, like of the UP Visayas and also the ISDA.
Okay. UP Visayas actually serves as the mentor of ISDA. Right now, they still work closely with them. They provide different capacity building, not only on DRR, but they also conduct leadership training, financial management orientation, of course, in partnership with other groups and other organizations. And at the local level, is that through those capacity building activities, they are actually promoting DRR at the household level. So they are teaching the families in basic disaster preparedness measures, like preparing their own emergency go bags so that they can easily go to the evacuation center when there's a typhoon or storm surge. They also, ISDA also holds their regular meetings to discuss not only disaster preparedness measures, but also how to influence the residents who are resistant in doing conservation efforts. How can they encourage them to do away from the unsafe livelihood activities like cutting of mangroves, cyanide fishing. So they right now they are very active in promoting those kinds of activity and advocacy.
And your last comment was on the transfer of roles, powers and roles from UP Visayas to the ISDA, because when I read the case study, the leadership role is more likely to be taken by the UP Visayas.
Yeah, as I've mentioned earlier, they have been conducting leadership training. So right now, I think second quarter of this year, they were able to elect officers, and those officers have assigned zones or assigned areas, so they lead the conduct of different DRR and conservation efforts in that area. So they are still in the process of transferring the leadership role to the ISDA.
And my last comment, maybe it's also useful if there is a like a time frame and milestones, mm-hmm. so that from this when you said from the low awareness and low initiative of the community to do the DRR until now, they have this mangrove rehabilitation conservations and some community led actions. How long the process is needed, and what is the milestone for each?
Thank you for your
comments
and suggestions.
Thank you. Well, my general comments are that this is a really impressive collaborative work. And having an impact as well as even after the completion of the project. As well as the, I followed your templates. well, I think this is a very good example of unity and diversity of this convergence strategy. But I would like to know more about about this convergence strategy we heard? Was it developed?
Mm-hmm.
How much time it took? And whether people's different actors' roles were clearly defined and followed?
Mm-hmm.
Because I could see that they were diverse and different activities carried out by different actors in different areas, which is very, very unique and new for me. But I'm much more interested to know more about ISDA, which is the Sustainable Development Alliance. Because sometimes, rather very often, alliances have little life.
Mm-hmm.
Once you achieve the objective, most alliances would disappear. So I'm interested to know more about it. You mentioned using religious festivals for advocacy purposes or employment.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to know about the composition of the partner communities and the actors. Do they belong to different religions? And did you find any difference as far as the response of the partners are concerned? Regarding official response is really fascinating as well, because that is not the case in Pakistan and in Kenya as well. Is it because of prolonged presence of civil society organizations, credible work in the Philippines, or it is a particular issue you just responded to Happy's query as well, and you stated that because of this new act which was enacted in 2010,
yeah.
We also have the same after 2005 earthquake, we also enacted a law which is called National Disaster Management Act. It also says and allocate responsibilities to different tiers of the government. But then it also clashes with the Local Government Act, because under the Disaster Management Act, the responsibility of disaster management lies with the district administration. But as far as the Local Government Act is concerned, it doesn't say anything about it. So there is a legal lacuna. So we need to understand that as well. You have also mentioned that because of this work, the underlying causes of vulnerabilities are being addressed, which is very interesting. This I could not understand. This illegal fishing, by whom? Is it by people? Poor people?
Actually, it's a combination of poor people and those who have big resources, big boats.
Because what we are advocating in Pakistan, because the riverine communities should not be stopped, because these are their livelihoods. It's basically primarily the commercial fishing which is causing problem, not because traditionally speaking people have this tendency to use their livelihood or resources, local resources, only to consume.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that if they cut trees every day and start selling the trees, then of course they would undermine their own livelihoods.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly the case with the fishing. So they only fish as much as the need, not to sell. And this was this has been the case for a long time. And then fishing became the state monopoly. So the state has started contracting out to private fishing companies. So they overdo fishing. So as a result of that, of course, the livelihoods of the local people disappear, and of course that also caused malnutrition, because this is very important. So I think you also talked about motorcycles. Hiding a motorcycle has caused, I could not make any sense of that. Because it is also a livelihood of some people. So is it the motorcycle hiring, or it is the misuse of motorcycles, or the way they are driven? So we NGOs tend to look at communities as a homogeneous group. They're not. There are clashes between gender perspectives. Communities have poor people as well. They have well-off people as well. Rural farmer has its own priorities, and people who go out and work or have visitors, they have their own interests. So your study tend to look at community as a whole, as a homogeneous group. So how, if there were dynamics, how did you or this group convergence strategy address various interests within the community? So these are my some comments. But you also talked about corruption and poor governance. Thank you.
So I'll just answer your last comment, because it's easier than going back to the first one. Okay. So how does the convergence strategy address the differences? Actually, through the convergence strategy, regular dialogues are held, not only among the local or the residents in the islands, but also actors from the local government, from the civil society organizations, and sometimes even representatives from the regional offices of national government agencies are invited to sit in the meetings. And during those meetings, they discuss their priority projects and programs that concern the island development. So through those regular meetings, duplication is prevented, because everyone is able to identify their focus or priority area. So resources are also maximized, because the responsibilities are shared among the different actors. And also the representatives, like sectoral representatives from the community, are able to sit down during the meeting. So the vulnerable groups like women, youth, older persons are also able to share their ideas or the ways they think that will help promote or achieve sustainable development in their islands. So it provides a very good platform for sharing and for identifying context-specific programs and strategies. So convergence strategy, so you were asking how much it took to form the alliance and all. So it really started in 2015. So after Typhoon Haiyan in 2013, UP Visayas was able to access funding from Christian Aid to implement a recovery and rehabilitation program called RISE. So the RISE project became an opportunity to conduct capacity building activities, community education, risk assessments, mangrove planting, so diverse menu of DRR and CCA activities. So as part of their sustainability mechanism, so they implemented those activities in 2014. In 2015, I think August 2015, they thought of organizing the alliance to sustain the initiatives that were started. So the alliance is actually an umbrella organization of 12 community-based groups from the four barangays in the island. So the composition of the alliance are members of barangay or village development councils, village health workers, village police, youth. So it's mainly from the grassroots, the membership. And in terms of roles, so most of them are right now are involved in influencing the barangays or the areas, the zones in the villages. So they conduct awareness raising activities, and they encourage especially the youth in doing environmental protection activities like mangrove planting, cleanup activities. So that's the role of the ISDA and the different sectoral groups in the barangay. For the CSOs, mainly the CSO members of the convergence provide technical and financial support. So through the leadership of UP Visayas, they conduct different trainings on livelihood, disaster risk reduction, environmental protection, sustainable development. And the NGOs, since they have the funding, they usually provide financial support. So Save the Children was there. They implemented several activities in 2015 until 2016. UNICEF also implemented a capacity building project for the children and youth. Foundation for the Philippine Environment, it's also a non-government organization, organized an activity for 26 youth in the islands, and they taught them how to do marine conservation. So actually, they provide different capacity building and technical assistance. The professors from UP Visayas are also engaged in doing capacity building. So they teach the communities, especially the members of the ISDA, to do basic financing, because they are providing livelihood support. So they teach the women in doing accounting for them to sustain the livelihood activities that the organization provided. For the religious festivals, it became a good opportunity for the alliance to promote their work through the religious festivals. During religious festivals, all the residents gather in one place, and they have various activities. So one of the activities that the alliance initiated during one of the religious activities that they implemented was the promotion of the culture in the island. So they actually, the target is the youth, for them to appreciate the island, because most of the youth in the community, they tend to leave the islands in search for greener pasture. So they go to the mainland or they go to the city. So through those religious activities, they are able to appreciate more the value of the islands, the value of their presence. UP Visayas and the Alliance also did some documentation activity to document the history of Gigantes. So this is also a way of raising the awareness of the children and youth to invest in conservation efforts to preserve their resources. The civil society organizations also play a very active role because through the law that I've mentioned earlier, the civil society organization has 4 seats in the National Disaster Risk Reduction and Management Council. So actually, our organization, CDP, is one of the 4 civil society organizations sitting in the council. So we are called every time they have meetings, the council, so we are able to input in their in crafting the Philippine Disaster Risk Reduction and Management Plan. Actually, one of our biggest contribution in the council is that we introduced the community-based approach, so that the training department of the council is now promoting the manual that we produced, which is the community-based disaster risk reduction and management manual. So the manual is now used in organizing the RRM structure in the village level, in allocating funds, in doing the RR plans at the village level in consultation with different sectors.
So to what extent do you think that being part of the National Council?
Come again, right?
To what extent do you think that because of your presence in the National Council, your work at the community level helps?
Yeah, actually we already made a very big difference because before when the law was not yet enacted, the framework of the government is really response oriented.
Mm-hmm.
They just act only when the disaster is already there or when the emergency is already there. But through our continuous advocacy and lobbying efforts, we were able to put forward the community-based frame when the new law was passed in 2010.
And how often this meeting is held, convened?
Quarterly meeting at the national level.
Yeah. We also have a similar council, and headed by Prime Minister, and all the chief ministers and governors and foreign minister and defense minister members. But the meeting has not been held since 2013. I was asked to become the member of that committee. I said, I'm not interested. Because meetings are not held, so what is the point becoming a member of such a committee?
In the Philippines, a new president has a, I don't know if it's a good solution, but the solution he applied is to kill the drug dealer by the police, by the army. six
yeah,
months or 1 year. I don't know exactly the figure, 10,000 or more. I don't know if the solution, the population lack or fraud. So, now my question is not about this. No, it's about, because you are talking of a very smooth process. We sit together and we get some more, one chair more in a higher level of committee or management. So, and I'm sure that the next typhoon in Philippines will happen in 2 weeks or 1 month. There will be as more dead and more victims like Ayan or the other. So my question is, situation in Philippines is like this. Is the confrontation, I call confrontation, I don't know if it's a good word for this, is needed to get more with the involvement of the real involvement of the government. In Vietnam, we have involvement of government for the art. Yes, they publish report. And like in Philippines, when something happened, the prime minister is on the site after 2 hours, and after 6 hours, the Red Cross gives a t-shirt, they give an envelope to people. Okay, but globally, the situation is not changing. And in Vietnam, it's very difficult to have a confrontation among people with the local authority because or national, because you go to prison directly. So I would like to know in Philippines, how do you think that, because we have example, for example, of Pakistan, which our colleague promotes confrontation with the local or higher government to have some more involvement of the government. So how do you think in Philippines we can continue, okay, to sit together and have more meeting and so what do you feel? And I think in Indonesia it's quite similar. Or is there any case in Philippines where there were the, I don't say in Mindanao with a Muslim recently, but a real confrontation of local community against government for land issue, for whatever, and find solution for their development, including for the or because you are Catholic, you have to respect the authority. So could you illustrate a little more about this?
Actually, early this year, or I think that last quarter of 2016, a group of urban poor confronted the government because of their clamor for housing. And they became successful because they were assisted, again, by civil society organizations working on housing projects. So they went to the presidential palace, we call it Malacañang, and they did their lobbying efforts there. And they were successful. The government provided housing for, I think, 800 families. So, I think there are also cases wherein confrontation is needed to really push for the government to perform their duty as duty bearers.
Well, thank you, Terry. I think I'm going to follow the template. Before I go there, I want to address some issues that Sawa mentioned. This idea of official response. Looks like, for the case studies that I saw, relatively speaking, there's a lot more official response in these countries than in Cameroon. And in the cases like the Philippines, you mentioned the typhoon in 2013 that happened and triggered a lot of things. I think the idea would be to get things done before the disaster. Because that is, when you save lives, when you preserve those lives which are lost in the disaster before the law comes in, that is what the big problem is. So how do we get the laws, like the case of Cameroon, we have floods, but we're trying to get the law coming and be applied before another disaster. This is a bit of an aside from this context. If you look at the genocide in Rwanda, 1994, happened, and there were the United Nations organs. The United Nations was present in Rwanda, but the United Nations, we all know what they do. They pulled out, and so many people were killed. Okay, and then they came back. One example. Another example, if the earthquake of Nepal, 2015, so many people came, so many organizations came. How do we move this organization to come before the disaster? And when they come with a lot of money, a lot of technical know-how. How do we make them come at this time that we are sitting here? How did this kind of meeting move such organizations to go into an area and act before the disaster strikes? This is where we are advocating. I'm going to share this with I'm going to give this to John. They will share. This is our work in 2015, the frontline work in 2015. So this is where I think we have to focus. We're in Cameroon, we don't have a major disaster yet. Our target is changing the law so that when the disaster comes, the law is in place and active. Mm-hmm. This is the comment I want to give related to what also said. Then, what new ideas do I discover in the case study of the Philippines? I think the idea of convergence itself, he said, is new to me. You know, mobilizing many actors and identifying their roles, and then eventually moving up to tackle other issues like the environment, like the climate change and things like that is really a great idea. So many actors, so many different actors. But I think the trick we had was each of the actors had their roles, including the academia, had their roles defined. This is the catch. What do you notice difference between your own work and the experience as read in this case study? Disaster Risk Reduction and Management and Civil Defense Departments closely work together. That's very different from you and us. Particularly the Kales Local Government Law, the order of EO 58.
Yeah, executive.
I think it did a lot to influence different partners, the environment, the tourism, and so on. I think that was great. In Cameroon, not even the provincial region, there are 10 regions in Cameroon, administratively. They all come to 10 regions. Not even the regional governor, who is the most powerful person, can decide anything. When there is a flood, for example, a landslide, and then the Department of Civil Defense, the Ministry of Territorial Administration and Decentralization, it is there, that's the director, very powerful guy. So he then sends a word to the governor, and then but it starts from bottom up and then from up down. A landslide occurs in a small locality. People are killed. Then the local chief goes and tells the local administrator, oh, we've got a landslide here. And then, if he wants, he tells his higher boss, and then the higher boss goes to the governor. The governor goes to the presidency. The presidency comes down to territorial administration. The territorial administration mobilizes and then calls for the scientists. That could take months, okay? In the case of everyday disaster, like the landslide, or but in the case of a big disaster that had big impact, hundreds of people die, it's immediate. The aeroplane comes with the civil defense army and a lot of money. So we want this to happen before. The laws come there. So that's a big difference between you and us. You also mentioned the basic limitation in basic services like schools and hospitals in your area, the Gigantes environment. With us, the schools are available, but the limitation is imposed mainly by the means, the lack of, because the schools are not free. Even if they say they are government schools, but parents still have to contribute. That limits the number of children who go to school, and even the hospitals. You go to the hospital, the government sends a medical doctor, but then you have to pay some money. So some people die, not because they cannot have access to the hospital, like the case because of the distance, but because when they go, they don't have the money to pay. What would you like to know more about this case study? From an NGO perspective, how easy was it for UP fee to mobilize local actors, particularly government departments, the tourism, agri, planning, development, to buy the idea of rice. So how is it? Was it? I think you have already answered the question partially from other observers. Apart from their time, did the barangays themselves have to contribute money to the implementation of rice? No.
No money. Just their time and
just
effort,
their time.
Yeah.
Okay.
No monetary contribution.
Okay. So what degree of autonomy do municipal governments have with respect to the provincial government on matters of TDR? So, I mean, the law that is there,
mm-hmm.
if something happens, does the municipal, that's the lowest level of government, can it react immediately, and do they have the means, financial and technical, to react without orders from the next level of government?
It depends on the extent of the damage.
Okay.
So in the law, there's an indicator. So if only one zone is affected, then it is expected that the village, the DRRM council will work.
Mm.
But if it's more than three zones or more, yeah, the municipal has to intervene.
Okay.
They need to provide support.
So how many barangay community members actually hold leadership positions in the rice project?
You mean the members of the council?
The member of the locality.
From the four?
From the four, yes.
From
barangay
the four barangays. Maybe around 25?
Oh, yeah. And this leads me to the literacy level of that community.
Mm.
What is their literacy level?
Actually, it's not that high. Around 60?
60%.
60%.
Yeah, okay. So how do you enhance local communities for weather and climate forecasting?
Actually, last March 2017, they crafted a plan. It involves DRR and climate change adaptation and mitigation. And one of the agencies that they identified to tap to implement capacity building is the National Bureau,
okay.
The Weather Bureau. So they will be providing support for that.
So what do you think this case study adds to your understanding of local voices? And I think when local voices are considered, they move things ahead a lot, including, for example, use of traditional methods. Along the Mount Cameroon area, we started the project of monitoring the volcano seismically. This is science. But the experience we got was that the local people have been there for I don't know how many hundred years. The houses, the local houses that they built, the volcano has erupted more than 8 times within the last 100 years. But no local person was ever killed by the lava. Because their houses and where they build their houses, they know where the lava flows. But because of population pressure, everybody's coming and building wherever, without respecting those traditional norms, and then they are getting affected. So I think when local voices are considered, there can be a lot of reduction in the casualties imposed by disasters. So how can you strengthen the example? I think this is a good comprehensive example of realization of different stakeholders to tackle resilient issues via identified spread responsibilities. The question I'll be asking here is, how do we vulgarize the Filipino example? And I think this issue, this special issue on disaster management, is a great way to vulgarize that example. Thank you.
What I see is really interesting, and I don't know how we can work with this in the next the coming days, is that what we're getting from my impression is a view which is questions about your case study, which are one thing, and then another really interesting layer of question and comment coming from a lot of saying, Okay, so what your case study, Grace, raises as questions, raises another set of questions and pieces of information from, say, Sarawar and from Festus, which are about your case study, so that we have like different baskets of information and ideas which we need to think how to manage that. At the end, maybe this is going to be how we individually, and then Terry and I also think about it. But it's quite complex, the way you are moving your ideas. An example from saying, in Pakistan it's like this, we don't have meetings, but here we hold meetings once every quarter. It's these little or big differences in cultural and governmental behavior that may be one of the things that Terry and I can contribute to later, and how we say we compare the 10 case studies we all have and say what's interesting within this state we have this system working, and in this other location we have something legally set up in the same way but not working in the same way. So how do we address these seemingly situations where you can say, congratulations, you've signed this law, but one place says yes and the other place says fine. Yeah, we have the law, but we don't do anything about it. And there are many layers. I'm intrigued about how we perhaps in the process of these days, how we keep track of these comparison things in maybe in our note taking, thinking about that. I'm going to be unfair and say we have to try and move on to Ruiti, and thank you, Grace, very much, and thank you for three, four of you.
Can I just chip in for a moment and hand back to you to hand over to Ruiti, John? Just four things that I picked out, which I'm not going to talk about, just mention, because I think they may crop up again. One of them is the role of individuals. A couple of things you mentioned. One is the positive relationship with the governor.
Yeah.
You know, so that's an individual that becomes an entry point. Another is talking more generally about things like leadership training. And it seems to me that from this and other cases I've heard, when there are particular leaders with positive influence, I'm talking probably locally here, when there are entrepreneurs who have that sort of skill to make things happen, when there are facilitators who can mobilize community groups, you know, again, these are individuals, and, you know, it's not just a system and a process, it depends on personalities. And when you listen to particular stories, often it's down to a particular individual with one of those skills, leadership, influence, entrepreneurial facilitator. So that's something online. An underlying issue, which came out of both what you talked about and some of the responses, is in the end, poverty and lack of livelihoods is going to be an unavoidable driver of continuing issues, whether it's people being driven to ride motorbikes unsafely, which I've experienced personally, and John has, whether it's people over-exploiting natural resources, fishing or woodlands, or whether it's access to health and education, as Aka mentioned, you know, that underlying issue of we can talk about response or disaster risk reduction, but if the people have a lack of sustainable lives at the end of the day, all of this can at worst be just a kind of sticking plaster on a bigger problem. So again, I'm not opening that up for discussion at this point, I'm just holding that thought. The role of, in particular, NGOs. It sounds like that was positive, and I don't want to hear more because we're out of time, but NGOs providing support, we often hear, comes with strings attached which constrain what you can do. So how can you do something like this convergence program without the support from NGOs steering it in the direction which is less than positive. Finally, again, a continuing theme is how do we shift the focus from response, you know, and Haiyan and earlier disasters in Philippines were great opportunities to move things forward. But as Akka said, in many cases, governments have a focus which is only on that large-scale disaster response. It's not on the preparedness which would reduce the need for response, and it's not on the small scale, what we sometimes call everyday disasters, which in a lot of cases are what are eroding people's lives and livelihoods. So those are just some of the headlines that I've noted myself, which I will keep in mind as we carry on discussing.
Right, I'm going to be a little bit sort of, actually we have theoretically 15 minutes for Kiribati, which won't do. So we can take time out of tea if need be, democratically voting. So